one of the biggest challenges is we do a ton of great work in our sessions, but if you're not carrying what we've talked about and what we teach into every single week and every single day, you're not going to get what you want out of this. My dad, Mark, has been an implementer for the better part of 15 years, co-author of the book Rocket Fuel. So I've been around these concepts for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. So when I was doing some research, I was like, holy crap, Blake's dad is Mark Winters, the Mark Winters.
When I'm first interacting with a client and I'm potentially going to come in as their implementer, we have something called the 90-minute meeting. And in that 90-minute meeting, they learn a bit about me, I learn a bit about them, and then I sort of give them an overview of what EOS is.
But what are some other strategies you would recommend to keep visionaries and integrators on the same page besides that meeting?
But it's that opportunity to detach a little bit. We talk about working in the business versus working on the business.
Yeah.
And there's a different mindset when you do that. And that's the same thing that would have happened in a same page meeting, where you're just kind of detaching one layer above the day-to-day chaos.
Yeah.
Talking strategically, solving some of those high level issues.
My team is going to hate me now because I'm going to use that exact phrase. I'm going to be like, what can we commit to in the next 7 days?
Yeah, that's exactly the verbiage that you need to use. What can we commit to in the next 7 days? Maybe just a small, minor task. And maybe I need to call the vendor. I need to try to get a hold of them. Okay, well, let's commit to that. But if we're committing to that, we need to get that done.
Right.
No excuses.
Welcome to The Show Goes On, a podcast about the people who keep the businesses running behind the scenes. My name is Amir Narani, and today I'm joined by Blake Winters. Blake Winters is an EOS implementer who helps entrepreneurs get what they want from their businesses. Drawing on years of hands-on leadership experience, he guides teams to gain clarity, accountability, and alignment through the entrepreneurial operating system. Blake's approach is practical and engaging, helping leaders build healthier, more disciplined organizations that achieve real results. He's passionate about turning vision into execution so founders can run better businesses and live better lives. Blake, thanks for being here today. How are you?
I'm great. Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
So usually I do those podcasts and like I'm kind of meeting the person for the first time. And I think what's funny is like I see you like once a week. So
yeah, we do run into each other once a week, sometimes even more than once a week.
Yeah, yeah. So we go to the same gym. That's why we run into each other at Lifetime Fitness and coached by the great Micah Cooper.
Yeah, it's a meeting of minds of sort. We've got, you know, both of us with our friend Mark Cuban there, yeah, as well as some other very respected business people out in the DFW community.
I had to shout out Micah. I don't think he'll listen to this, but I think he posted a clip one time of like Mark Cuban not giving him a shout out, and he got really upset at Mark and called him out in class and everything. So just in case Micah decides to listen to a podcast about business leaders and EOS, then he'll be like, okay, I got the shout out.
Shout out Micah Cooper, class with Coop, Dallas Lifetime in Highland Park. Come check it out.
It's a fun class, man. I mean, I was just talking to you about it. Like this morning's workout was tough. A lot of legs. Tuesday is always legs day.
Yeah, Tuesday is always leg day. That's a tough one. Thursday is high rocks training, which is just absolutely brutal. Takes me back to the old football workouts where I'm gravitating towards a trash can, not sure if I'm going to be able to hold my stomach together. So yeah, a lot of good work happens in just about 45 minutes every day.
Yeah, for sure. And you guys won't be able to tell about it from the desk, like where the angle is, but Blake is ripped. This guy is super strong. He's always like in the strong corner and I'm like off to the side. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to start off on the platform.
You're giving me too much credit here.
All right. So let's just jump straight into it. You have a very unique relationship with EOS, which we'll get into in a little bit. But take me back to how this all started for you. Like talk to me about what your career was before EOS and then we'll jump into it.
Yeah. So I grew up in an entrepreneurial household. So small businesses, family businesses, dynamic businesses have been something that I've always been around. And with that, growing up, you saw the successes and the failures of the full entrepreneurial cycle as my parents, you know, started, closed, sold, bought numerous businesses throughout my upbringing. But also what really stood out to me was the freedoms and flexibilities that being an entrepreneur allowed. So I always had it in my mind that that's somewhere I wanted to go down the line, but unsure of exactly how that was going to happen. All that being said, you know, I go to school and I say, all right, how am I going to make the most money possible? Because when you're 18, what sounds attractive?
Money.
A little ching ching, right? So start looking through the majors, go into Google, which major pays the most money, find out that it's chemical engineering and pre-med. So it's like, boom, there it is. I'm going to be a chemical engineer pre-med. Not really fully understanding exactly what I was signing up for with that. So as my college journey evolves, drop pre-med, realize, you know, every time I see blood, I get a little bit sick to my stomach. So I'm certainly not doing that. So now I'm an industrial engineer. What's an industrial engineer? In my definition, it's sort of where engineering blends with business, which was really attractive to me because I love numbers. I'm a total math guy, but also I feel like I've got a good business sense, and that's probably where I see my future being. So graduate school with a degree in industrial and systems engineering, and I go to one of the big four consulting firms and start my career as a consultant because consultants get to travel Monday through Thursday. They get a lot of airline miles, you get hotel points, and it's this lavish lifestyle that just sounded super incredible. And for a while, it was pretty incredible. But after a couple of years of doing that, it was just like, all right, it's time to get back to my entrepreneurial roots. This is just a beast of an organization. I think there was like a couple hundred thousand people working for the organization. It was just like, you know, you could see your path up, but a lot of red tape. It was very bureaucratic. All that to say, I was like, all right, it's time to go be a part of an entrepreneurial organization. That itch was just calling me. So it was at that point that I left, still staying on with the consulting track, and I joined a small, about 30-person at the time firm that was doing consulting both in Dallas and Denver. And as I'm interviewing with this company, start throwing out terms like visionary, integrator. I'm like, hold on, I think I've heard these terms before. Find out that they're, you know, about to embark on their own EOS journey. So join the organization. We bring in an EOS implementer and we go on our EOS journey, start implementing EOS, getting strong in the six key components. And while I was at that organization, we got super strong in the people component, I would say, and super strong in the process component, which of course, in turn, made our organization attractive. So much so that we sold to another, not quite as large as my first firm, but larger than 30 people firm, transitioned into that new business of still in the consulting thing. And after a couple of years of doing that, I sort of had a soul searching moment of like, what do you love to do? What are you great at? What excites you? And for me, it was teaching and facilitation. And I totally believe in EOS. It was like, well, why don't I go teach and facilitate that? And I've been doing that ever since. And the way that this all kind of connects is my dad, Mark, has been an implementer for the better part of 15 years. Co-author of the book Rocket Fuel. So I've been around these concepts for a very, very long time. But I'll say that it wasn't until I got to see it firsthand in my own business that I really understood what it was all about. Because before that, it was, oh, that's dad's job. Whatever dad talks about is what dad talks about. I'm not going to listen to any of that stuff. Right, as any good kid does, they ignore everything that their parents say.
Oh, yeah.
But seeing how it impacted our business, it was like, okay, I get it. This actually works. This makes sense. And I've been teaching it ever since. And it's been a blast, man.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. So when I was doing some research, I was like, holy crap, Blake's dad is Mark Winters, the Mark Winters. I think I've run into him before at a conference or something. But and then I saw that he wrote Rocket Fuel, which I've read before. And, you know, it just got me thinking, like you referenced EOS earlier. You heard about these concepts growing up. Did you know fully what EOS is all about, or was it something where you just, like you said earlier, you just heard it and kind of moved on?
You know, understand more than probably I gave myself credit for. Mm-hmm. Just kind of like being a sponge and listening. But EOS it's simple, but it's not very easy to communicate quickly, right? So that's why when I'm first interacting with a client and I'm potentially going to come in as their implementer, we have something called the 90-minute meeting. And in that 90-minute meeting, they learn a bit about me. I learn a bit about them. And then I sort of give them an overview of what EOS is and then talk about the process of what implementation actually looks like. Because it takes about 90 minutes to get that across. It's not something that you can easily say in 1 to 2 minutes and have people fully understand. You know, it's a system used to help run your business and help you get what you want out of your business. Okay, tell me more. Good point. Let's set up 90 minutes and I'll be able to tell you more. So it was a lot of terminology I was familiar with. It was concepts, but seeing how it all actually worked in reality in an actual business, I wasn't exposed to that side of it. So it was kind of, okay, this is actually how all this works now. I've seen it. I see it and I've seen it be successful. Now I truly understand it.
Yeah. And I think that's really cool how you were working in a totally different business and you started hearing all these concepts thrown around and you're like, wait a minute, I know about all this stuff already.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, especially him being co-author of Rocket Fuel and Visionaries and Integrators, you know, those two terms in particular. That's why when I first heard those, it was like my ears perked up. Oh, yeah. Okay, I know what those are. So at least that side of things I've been intimately familiar with for a long time. But things like the Level 10 meeting, rocks, it was seeing those firsthand and actually being a part of those that truly made me understand that side of things.
Yeah, that's super cool. So in Rocket Fuel, remind me again, it talks mainly about the relationship between the visionary and the integrator, correct?
Yeah. So that's all about maximizing that relationship that sits at the top of the accountability chart. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. And I've talked to previous guests about this. And, you know, one of the strategies they mentioned from the book is having that same page meeting, the SPM. And so I really love that meeting. And I think it goes a long way towards helping visionaries and integrators. My brother's a visionary and I'm more of an integrator.
Okay.
So we try to do our SPM. We're not great at it, but we try to. But what are some other strategies you would recommend to keep visionaries and integrators on the same page besides that meeting?
I think more than anything, it's just having like a healthy respect for one another. So in the book, it talks about, you know, visionaries being wired one way and integrators being wired another. And it's written from the perspective of, you know, the polar ends, like the polar far ends. In reality, a visionary and an integrator and a lot of companies I work with are not quite as different as the book makes them out to be. There are some companies where that absolutely is the case. Mm-hmm. So it's finding the right match for how visionary or how strong of an integrator you are. So there may be someone that is truly a million ideas, a million miles an hour every second. This person cannot be contained. Well, then they need a really strong integrator who can rein them in. Yeah. Now, if there's someone who's moderately like that, it's figuring out, all right, where are their gaps and getting an integrator to be able to fill in. But understanding that these individuals are different, it's having a healthy respect towards one another and the way that you work and the way that you approach your work and really keeping that dialogue open, which is why the same page meeting is so important, because it's that forum to be able to voice your concerns in a more private setting as opposed to in front of the entire leadership team or in front of the entire company.
Yeah.
So the same page meeting is absolutely critical. I'd actually be curious in your example, what about that meeting are you and your brother struggling with?
Consistency. That's okay. One of the things I was going to laugh about is like, oh, okay, so it should be done monthly, right?
Not a specific cadence. So monthly at a minimum, I would say. I've got some that do it every 2 weeks.
Oh,
there may be periods of time where, you know, you're mulling on a major decision. Are we going to acquire another company? Are we going to sell our company? Yeah. Right. And that may warrant even doing it once a week, but once a month is kind of your standard cadence and then adjust it from there as needed.
Yeah, that's a good rule of thumb. So that's where we're going wrong. We're doing it like once a quarter right now, so we should probably bump it up right now. So
yeah, it's just discipline. You know, get it on the calendar, especially if it's your brother. You know, it doesn't need to be super formal. Heck, you know, go play golf and make sure you've got your issues listed out before you do that. But as long as you're talking through things, whatever forum, a cigar bar I've heard people talk about a lot, or a nice cocktail bar, whatever you fancy, you know, get it on the calendar, make it kind of fun, and then just stick to it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the issue can sometimes be where if you're already around each other all the time, if the visionary and the integrator already spend a lot of time, then they may say to themselves, well, why do we need to meet again? Like we see each other every day, but I'm sure there's more value to it than just that.
Yeah, you know, and it's really just a mindset. So it's not different than when a leadership team comes in for a quarterly session. A leadership team, they're meeting every week in their level 10 meeting. Also, they're running the business. So they're meeting far more than that. They're together all the time, but it's that opportunity to detach a little bit. We talk about working in the business versus working on the business.
Yeah.
And there's a different mindset when you do that. And that's the same thing that would have happened in a same page meeting, where you're just kind of detaching one layer above the day-to-day chaos,
yeah,
talking strategically, solving some of those high level issues.
Yeah. I love that. Detaching one layer above, that's so important, because when you can kind of remove yourself from the day-to-day, the whole idea of not working in it, working on it.
When you can get out of firefighter mode.
Yeah. For sure. Okay. So you referenced this earlier, and I thought this was fascinating, about you had like a soul searching moment when you decided you wanted to do something else. So take me back to that. What was that all like for you?
I found myself comfortable. I was successful in my role. I reached senior manager at a young age. Company had been around for 20 years. I was the youngest person to ever reach senior manager. Saw my path up through partner. We didn't call it partner, but essentially on a partner track for a consulting firm. And it was challenging, but it was just something needed to be different. I didn't see the rest of my life following on that path. And I was at a point in my personal life where I could go take a risk. Mm-hmm. So I had a decent nest egg of money that I've set aside. I don't really have children right now, so I'm not worried about putting food on the table for my family. If anyone's going to suffer from my failures, at that point, it was just Blake that was going to suffer, and Blake can live with that. So it was just a really perfect opportunity for me to take that entrepreneurial leap and try something that was admittedly really scary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when thinking about what that next opportunity looks like, there were some other things that I explored in a very minimal capacity. So it was kind of very quickly onto, all right, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be an ELS implementer. And I spent about a year before I actually made that leap preparing, because obviously I've got a great mentor and a resource in my father that was instrumental in sort of talking me through the process of, I think you can do this, just reassurance and confidence. But I also really was nervous that I was going to come in, and this was a lot of head trash that I deal with, that I was going to come in and it was, all right, well, Blake's just Mark's son. What can he really do? So I prepared like a maniac. And then I went into boot camp. And basically the point of boot camp is to get briefed on EOS, learn the way things work, learn the ins and outs of running and implementer practice, and being able to deliver a effective 90-minute meeting. And I came in with this 90-minute meeting. I'll pat myself on the back a little bit. It was spot on. And that was because I had trained like a maniac for 12 months leading up to it, because the last thing I wanted to do was show up, be unprepared, and sort of have that, oh, well, that's just Mark's son type of reputation. So
I love how you embraced that pressure, how you were like, hey, you know, that's not going to be me. Let me just prepare like a maniac and outwork everyone. You know?
Yeah, I laugh because, you know, you talk about, in interviews at companies, it's like, you know, what are your three greatest strengths and what's your weakness? And the weakness is always some cheesy answer like, oh, I work too hard. I deliver too much shareholder value. I care too much. But, you know, for me, I'm a really, really tough critic on myself. And, you know, we were talking before we started this podcast, so sometimes, you know, we wake up at 3:45 in the morning, so we go to the 5:30 a.m. class. And that's because sometimes, you know, it's hard to sleep because I've just got my brain and my thoughts, you know, wrapped around themselves.
Yeah.
So I really do put a lot of pressure on myself. But that pressure on myself is really what's been able to springboard every facet of my career at every step of the way, you know, carried through now being an implementer.
Yeah. Where did that work ethic come from? You said you were preparing like a maniac, but like, where is that drive? Where did that come from?
I'd say that probably came from both of my parents who, whether it was in school or anything less than an A was was unacceptable, which then turned into even low A's being, you know, oh, you got a 93. Why didn't you get a 97? You got a 97. Why didn't you get 100? So just kind of hearing that pressure, it just sort of put it within me. And then also from, you know, a competitive sports background, whether it was football or swimming when I was younger, or track, basketball, you know, played a bunch of sports growing up. Just have, I have a really competitive nature. I absolutely hate losing. And one of the best ways you can minimize losing is by being very, very prepared and training really hard. And, you know, now I carry that same mindset into the gym. I'm not really training for anything, but, you know, when I'm there and I'm at the opportunity and I've set aside an hour of my day to exercise, well, you know, there's no benefit in me, you know, half-assing that. I'm going to go ahead and give it all that I've got and make it the most productive hour that I possibly can and let the results be what they are.
Yeah, you got to show up and show out. I think Kobe said something about how I've prepared so much leading up to the game where by the time the game comes, I'm not nervous anymore. And if I am, that means I didn't do enough leading up.
Yep. To- yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's funny. So, you know, you do all this preparation, especially, you know, talking about becoming an implementer. You know, I prepare so hard. I've got all the material down. And then you actually get in front of a client and it's like, oh, my gosh. It's like the wind gets knocked out of you and you don't know why you're nervous because you've done all this preparation. So those first couple of sessions they went well. But now it's just basically like second nature. It's the preparation work is done. Now it's just, I can truly be present for those teams, understanding where they're at and helping them by the end of the day together be a better version than they were when they walked in the morning.
Yeah. How were those first couple of sessions? I guess you were pretty nervous, huh?
Nervous, you know, nervous is an accurate description of it. But then once it gets started and you talk, you know, you hear about this all the time in sports. It's, you know, the butterflies are there. And then like in football, you get hit once.
Yeah.
And then you're just playing the game.
Yeah.
So once you get in the flow of the meeting, and those first couple meetings, it all happened very naturally. But now it's just pure excitement before the sessions because you never know what you're going to see. You never know what question you're going to ask to, you know, bring out some issue that's just been bottled up for a long time that really needs to be addressed that just hasn't been uncorked. Well, the job that implementers are brought in to do is to uncork those issues, get them out on the table. That way we can actually get them resolved.
Yeah. It's almost like I'm just thinking about it right now. I'm just thinking about this analogy where, as implementers, you're almost like athletes. And like when you come into that quarterly session or that annual session, that's like the game. And the game starts, the lights go on, and like you're just on.
Anytime. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of the way that I approach everything. You know, it's just like it's my game day. And yeah, I wake up and I've got a pretty consistent routine for the night before and the morning of the session because it's, you know, 7 hours plus or minus an hour.
Yeah.
It's a lot of facilitation. It's also not cheap, right? My clients pay a decent price for me to be facilitating these sessions, and I want to give them my very best. So that means getting to bed at the appropriate time the night before, fueling my body. That way I can, you know, be able to be the best version of myself, which is exactly what they need. It's what they're paying for,
right?
That I can possibly be for them.
Yeah, I love that. What are some other things that you do to prepare? You said you get to sleep on time, you're fueling up. What are some other tactics that you use to just become the best version of yourself, for yourself and for your clients?
So I refresh myself on where the client currently is. So during every session, I'm taking notes. After every session, I debrief and take some notes based on how the session went. A lot of my clients use a software platform like success.co, like 90.io, where they manage a lot of their EOS paperwork. They've got their level 10 meetings in there. I can see their issues list. So I take some time to comb through all that to say, all right, well, I saw you 90 days ago and I can remember, go back and look at my notes and see what we discussed then. What were the pressing issues? What were the big solves? What did we not get to? See how things have gone over the course of the 90 days. Were they having all of their level 10 meetings? Were they doing all of their to-dos to get a sense of where things are more close to the session? That way I can come in with a good idea of where things stand and we can really hit the ground running.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you do a lot of prep work beforehand just to stay updated on the client.
Yep.
So of the six components, I think there's six, right? Components.
There's six. Yep. We've got it right here behind me.
Yeah. I thought it was seven. And then I looked over there and I was like, oh, that's six. So, of the six, I'm curious, when you're working with clients, what's the one component that you consistently see? I guess I would call it subpar performance in.
People. We spend the majority of the time. So when we talk about IDSing an issue, identify the real root cause, discuss it, and solve it, meaning that we make a decision, we put a plan in place. As you IDS a lot of the issues, a lot of times what's written on the issues list, the issue that we think they're solving, is really just a symptom. So we're stripping back the layers to get to what really is the root cause of that issue. A lot of times it comes down to a people issue. And it's solving that people issue. And people issues are so hard to solve because finding great talent is really, really challenging, especially in today's environment. It's hard to find them. And then once you find them, it can be really hard to keep them if they're good, because everyone else wants good people. Mm-hmm. And there's not unlimited strong people. And we define strong people based on your specific organization. So do they fit the culture of your organization? And can they actually do the job that's asked of them? That's right people and right seat. And a lot of times when companies come across a people issue, they're hesitant to make a change because their mindset is what we have right now is better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And the fear is that if we get rid of that person and we have no one to replace them, then someone else who's already overloaded is going to have to step in to fill that void, or we're just not going to do any of that work that's needed to do at all. Or how long is it going to take to find someone to backfill that position? All of those questions get wrapped in their minds. And a lot of times you'll see companies sit on bad people when they're not willing to make that change. When I've seen time and time again, when you do make that change, when you are bold with it, you're better off in the long run.
Yeah.
So I would say the people issue is where, when I start a client, a lot of their issues reside. We work through those. And then later down the line, the process component is sort of the last one that gets up to speed. We don't worry about it too early on in the implementation process, but the process component is really just getting the most important things done the right and best way over time. It's standardizing your processes. It's documenting them simply and getting them followed by all, which takes time to be able to actually accurately define the right way of doing things, not just the way that we've always done it, which sometimes I'll see clients try to do that quickly. They just quickly document, well, here's the way we do everything, without asking themselves, is that really the best way to go about doing it?
Yeah.
So that's an iterative process to eventually get those processes up to snuff to where that really is the best and most effective way to do it. Get that documented and then communicated, trained, and ensure people are actually executing on those properly.
Yeah. On the people side, like, so let's say they've identified someone that's just not working out. Do you all make that decision in the room, or is that something that you give to the leadership team to take back? You take them through the GWC exercise if they need to remove that person? How does that whole process work?
Yeah. So as an implementer, I'm never making that decision. That's one of the things when I'm working with a client, I draw a clear line where I'm never going to tell them you need to go fire that person. Mm-hmm. Rather, what I'll do is I'll take them through the people analyzer exercise where, you know, we've got six people in the room and maybe not all six people know this individual well enough to be able to speak about their performance or about who they are personally, right? So then who in the room actually thinks that they have enough experience with this individual to have an opinion on them? Okay, well, let's run through the core values. Do they exhibit this core value most of the time? Most of the time, do they not? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So that's our plus, minus scale. Walking through each of the core values, we compare that to the bar, which is the minimum acceptable criteria for that person to be considered a right person. And then GWC. So what's their seat on the accountability chart? What are those five roles and responsibilities? Do they get it? Yes or no? Do they want it? Yes or no? Do they have the capacity to do it? Yes or no? So then we've got, based on whoever in the room was actually able to comment, we've got their people analyzer. And then we can quickly see, are they above the bar? Are they at the bar? Are they below the bar? And then based on how drastically they're either maybe a little bit below the bar or they're way below the bar, that opens up a discussion of, do we need to make a change right now? Do we need to sit down with them and communicate? We have a three strike rule that we recommend. It's sitting down and saying, hey, you know, you're not meeting expectations. Here's more explicitly where you're not meeting those expectations, as opposed to saying, we don't really like you. You're not doing a good job. It's, well, these two core values that are important to us, we just don't see that you're exhibiting those values. So we've communicated that with you. For the next 30 days, let's really try to get that back on track. Hopefully we get that resolved and we don't need to move to strike two or strike three. Now, sometimes when the people analyzer is minus, 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 no, 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 everyone in the room can quickly come to their senses and say, hey, there's no rescue in this one. We whiffed on the hire. Let's make a swift change.
Yeah. And I've often seen, going back to your point earlier of keeping good people, when, you know, you're able to, you know, for lack of better phrasing, remove the wrong people from the organization, it makes your good people happier, because then they're working only with A-team players, and A-team players want to work with other A-teamers then.
100%. So, you know, we talk about the people issues that you see are the right person in the wrong seat, yeah, which is someone that totally fits the culture. It's someone that everyone loves, but they can't do their job effectively. If I really like you as a person, but I'm working with you and you can't do your job, and I'm constantly having to step in and do your job for you, no matter how much I like you in workout class or how much I like you getting drinks after work at happy hour, if I'm doing your job for you, that's going to wear on our relationship. Right. It's eventually going to wear on me as an employee at this company.
Yeah.
And then vice versa. Obviously, if they're not a culture fit, but they're good at their job, it's not someone that you probably want to be around. So yeah, being surrounded by people that are right people in the right seats elevates the entire group.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you talked on your LinkedIn about the issue atomizer. Is that how you say it?
Yes, I've got that behind my head.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So I was watching that video and I found it very interesting, because that actually happens in our organization a lot. We get tripped up because we're talking about something that's not a rock, but it's not like a simple to do. So walk us through the issue atomizer and how to go through that process.
Yeah. So we've got rocks and we've got to do's. And I know you know this, but I'm just kind of teeing this up for the listener. So rocks are 90-day business objectives. What are the strategic objectives that we need to accomplish over the quarter that are going to advance our organization forward? So we set rocks based off of our current issues. What do we need to get accomplished? Well, we know we've got some issues to solve. So is there a number of issues that we can bundle into a big meaty rock and take care of that over the 90 days? Now, within that 90 days, we have other issues come up, because no one's running a perfect business and everyone has issues. And issues are not inherently bad. Issues can be opportunities. They can sometimes be good things that we want to be able to take advantage of. So as these short-term issues come up, short-term issues means we can't wait until past 90 days to get them solved. So sometimes we've got issues. We want to open a second office. Well, we're not going to worry about that this quarter. We may not even worry about it next quarter, but we may worry about it three quarters from now. That's a long-term issue that sits on our VTO. Think of that as your parking lot. A short-term issue may be the Wi-Fi went down and we can't quickly get it back up. There are things that we need to solve this week. Now, sometimes those issues are not as simple as, let's talk about it. Let's put a 7-day action item, because to-dos by definition are 7-day action items with the single owner. Sometimes that's not enough to get that issue resolved, but it's a big enough issue, an important enough issue, that it can't wait till the next 90-day cycle. So with that, we have something called the issue atomizer, which basically says, let's take that big meaty issue. Let's IDS it. Let's strip it down to the root cause. Let's discuss a path forward, and then let's commit to an action or couple of actions that we can get done in one calendar week. So what can we really get done in the next 7 days? Maybe that's, hey, we need to pull some data and we need to do some analysis on it. So that's what we can commit to getting done in the next 7 days with all the other 150 things we've got going on this week.
Yeah.
We do that. We come back the next week. We've done that analysis on that data. Oh, we've uncovered something new. So we IDS it again from the perspective of, what did we learn based on the analysis of that data? We discuss it again. We write another 7-day action item. Maybe now that issue is solved once we do that next action item. Maybe it's not. Maybe we IDS it again, write another 7-day action item, and we continue to iterate through that process until our issue is solved. Now, a lot of the times our issues can be fairly simple and 1 7-day cycle is enough to make that issue go away. Other times we have to rely on the issue atomizer where we're just distilling it down into 7-day chunks until the issue is fully resolved.
Yeah, I love that. And this is such a nuanced take in EOS, just because, you know, I've seen mistakes on our organization where we'll create a to-do and we'll schedule it like 3 weeks out. Okay, so we'll do that and it just sits on the to-do list. And of course, we don't get it done until like the day before, you know, but then it does get done. However, so many new things were learned in doing that to-do that was scheduled for 3 weeks out that we come back and we say, okay, done or not done. Well, it didn't get done because of so-and-so. So now we've waited 3 weeks and, you know, the to-do is not quite done. There's a lot of information that was learned along the way and now you're backed up again, right? And so now it's going to take 4 weeks to get a to-do done. Whereas in the process that you just described, maybe you're able to smoke out an issue within that larger issue within week one when you break it up into chunks.
Yep. Yeah. So we talk about SMART rocks, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. Your to-dos should also be written SMART. So for that to-do that you scheduled 3 weeks out from now, I would ask the question of, well, what can we commit to having done in the next 7 days?
Yeah.
And you write the rock that way. Maybe, you know, you can't get the full thing done that we said we would do in 3 weeks and 7 days, but a third of it or a portion of it,
yeah,
let's write it that way. Hold ourselves accountable, keep the iron to the fire. Let's get it done because 3 weeks is a long time.
Yeah, my team is going to hate me now because I'm going to use that exact phrase. I'm going to be like, what can we commit to in the next 7 days?
Yeah, that's exactly the verbiage that you need to use. What can we commit to in the next 7 days?
Yeah.
And it may be just a small, minor task. And maybe I need to call the vendor.
Yeah.
I need to try to get a hold of them. Okay, well, let's commit to that. But if we're committing to that, we need to get that done.
Right.
No excuses.
Right. How about milestones? How has that been working in Rocks? Do a lot of people make those milestones, or is it kind of just like a thing that we have there, but we don't really use them?
Yeah. So there's milestones from two perspectives. So you can have a milestone rock. So imagine you've got a year-long project. A milestone rock would be what, just like we were talking about with that 3 week to do down to a 1 week to do, we've got a year long project. What can we get done in the 90 days? And we write a milestone rock from that perspective, knowing we need to be 90 days into that year long project. And that's our rock. Now, within rocks, we can have milestones. Milestones are basically, you know, a 90 day cycle is about 13 weeks. Milestones would be, what are the key deliverables, the key things that we need to have accomplished at some points within that 90 days, maybe at week 4, week 8, week 11, maybe you have one every single week to say that we're on track with the rock. That's never required. I have some teams that absolutely love that and they're very transparent about that. So when they're saying on track or off track in their level 10 meetings, they know that every single person on the team has set milestones that's dictating whether the rock's on track or off track, as opposed to kind of just a gut feel. I've got some teams that just have a healthy trust amongst one another to where when someone says on track, they understand that it's on track. Off track, well, they're raising their hand saying, hey, the rock is off track. It needs to be put back on track. And then typically as you IDS through that, it gets down to specifically, what have you done? What have you not done? Why are you saying it's off track? How can we get things back on track? So not required. Some teams love it. Some don't. I don't mandate it by any means.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what I really like about that too, is when a rock is off track, you throw it into IDS because then you got to figure out why.
Yeah. And when you have the milestones, it makes that discussion a lot simpler.
Yep.
As you're IDSing through an off-track rock, you kind of start breaking it down into those chunks.
Yeah.
You know, typically the verbiage I'll use when I'm talking to clients about it is, however you manage your projects, you manage them.
Mm-hmm.
I am not very concerned as long as it gets done. Now, if you consistently have poor rock completion, maybe you need some milestones, or maybe you're not the right person in the right seat and you can't be held accountable, because we're committing to saying these are the most important things. Then what's getting in the way from you getting those things done?
Yeah.
So in that aspect, milestones can be helpful. Some people have like full on Gantt charts that they build, you know, day by day of what they need to get done. So that's an extreme case. No milestones is the other extreme case. Plenty of options in between. Really, whatever works for you. How do you successfully manage projects? What I care about at the end of the 90 days, what your team should care about, is the rock being done and successful.
Yeah. What if you get like halfway through the quarter, not even halfway, let's say a third of the way through the quarter, and you realize that this rock isn't as strong as you thought it really was, or it feels, I don't know, not like it wasn't strong enough. Can you up the rock? Can you remove the rock altogether and make something new? Like what's the protocol when it comes to something like that?
So rule of thumb is you never change a rock. As you go through a couple cycles of rock setting, you're going to get better at it. The first couple cycles, you're going to write some rocks that are either, there's absolutely no shot you were going to get that done within 90 days, or that took you more like 7 days than 90 days, and you learn from it. Mm-hmm. And you either scale it back or you scale it up. Now, there are some times where a rock becomes obsolete. You look up halfway through the quarter, and for whatever reason, something drastic has changed in the business to where we don't even need to do that anymore.
Yeah.
At that point, you can kill a rock. That should not happen more than once a year.
Wow.
So rule of thumb, once a year, kill a rock if you need to. But if I see that happening every quarter, I'm going to have some questions as to why that's happening.
Yeah.
But the general rule of thumb is you don't change the rock. You try your best to get it done, recalibrate, and set a better rock next quarter. There's something to just seeing through the not perfect rock that'll help you set better rocks in the future.
Yeah.
Kind of, you made your bed, now lay in it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I've heard the concept of you got to be able to hit at least 80% of your rocks as a team as well.
Yep. And the reason that it's not 80%, and I like to pop quiz a lot of my clients. It's like, all right, what percentage to do completion do we need? That's 90. What percentage rock completion do we expect? 80. And the reason that we expect 80% is two things. The first is we need to be challenging ourselves.
Yeah.
Don't write to-dos disguised as rocks. Or wait. Yeah, to-dos disguised as rocks just to say that you got everything done, because that's not moving our organization forward.
Yeah.
So we really need to challenge ourselves. These should take the better part of 90 days. If you don't get started in the first couple of weeks, it's going to be really hard to get the rock done, because we're signing up for a big, solid amount of work. The second thing is sometimes we do just come up short. Sometimes you're running a mile and you come up 100 meters short, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. So we need to be challenging ourselves. Sometimes things do come up that prevent us from getting that rock over the finish line. As long as that's less than 20% of the time, we can live with that.
Makes sense. I got one more for you, and then we're going to end with rapid fire. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So you talked about this earlier about teaching and facilitating. So I'm just curious, what is your favorite thing about being an implementer?
Seeing the teams lean into the process and be successful with it. Seeing that this process is adding value to their organization, it's adding value to their lives, and that value may come in the form of they have now more time to enjoy their families, to enjoy their personal lives, and seeing them be successful is really all you could ask for. Yeah. And I can leave work at the end of the day, my head can hit the pillow knowing that I made a positive impact on a group of people. And there's a lot of people that live lives where they can't say that they did that at the end of the day. And I don't take that for granted at all.
That's awesome, man. Thanks for sharing that. That was great. And I feel like you're seeing those results firsthand when you're inside the room with them and you're talking through the wins, even some of the failures, and then you're looking through the scorecard and the results speak for themselves. And I guess when companies start going through the EOS system, you know, you can start to see some relief because finally there's structure behind all the madness that's been going on.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges is we do a ton of great work in our sessions, but if you're not carrying what we've talked about and what we teach into every single week and every single day, you're not going to get what you want out of this.
Yeah.
So we come together, we have those high level discussions, we celebrate our successes. I'll push on you for your failures. That's my job, is to call things out for what they are. But if you're not doing those things every single day in between our 90-day touch points, don't bother with the OS. It's not going to work for you.
Yeah.
So like I said, it's the teams that really lean into it and they go all in that see the success. As with anything in life.
Yeah.
Go all in, lean in as hard as you can. Typically, you're going to reap the rewards that you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. All right. So we'll end with some rapid fire. Favorite book?
I'll say Rocket Fuel.
I knew you were going to say that. Nice. Favorite city when you were doing all your traveling?
Oh, San Diego.
Oh, cool city. Yeah.
I don't have any clients there yet, but I would really like some.
Yeah.
Because I absolutely love San Diego.
It's like the same weather as LA, but without all the traffic.
It's the same weather that I set my thermostat at year round. So it's pretty incredible.
Favorite movie or TV show?
Movie, Dark Knight, TV show of all time, Breaking Bad.
Amazing. I watch Dark Knight like once a quarter. No joke.
It's the best. It's the best, man. It's so good.
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. And then favorite sports team?
Oklahoma Sooners.
Oh,
tough weekend.
Oh yeah, that was hard. Yeah.
Oh man, tough weekend. But yeah, they're my ride or die. They dictate probably too much of my happiness.
So you're a Sooner guy. Are you come from a Sooner family?
Oh, Sooner family, multiple generations in Crimson and Cream. So just the next one in line to carry out this crazy fandom.
Nice. Blake, this is a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining today. I'll see you at the gym soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, this was fun. I appreciate you having me on, and we'll definitely see each other at the gym soon.
For sure. And before we sign off, any final takeaways you want to share with anyone?
Be passionate about what you do and do it to the best of your ability and live with the result.
Yeah, absolutely. Leaning into the process. I love that too.
And if you're interested in EOS, feel free to reach out to me. And if you're serious about it, said it multiple times, lean in and do it the right way.
Well said. Thanks, Blake.
Yep. Thank you.